Well, good evening, y'all. Thanks for coming. I really appreciate it. You could have done anything tonight, but you decided to come here. And that is exciting for me to stand up and experience all of this. If you haven't gotten a handout, I would encourage you to go ahead and grab one. I'm going to have most of the stuff up here on this screen, but I know it's difficult to see in the back. There's an outline on the first page, and the second page has some artwork that I'll refer to a couple of times tonight. So we're talking about, in this series, the four Gospels and their different portraits of Jesus. I'm going to talk about them as artistic narratives, and I'll explain what I mean by that shortly. Here, this is, in case you were wondering, from the Book of Kells. Some of you probably recognized it. We will talk about the four different figures shortly, but you'll see this again. And I believe it's on the back of your handout as well. So these are our goals for tonight. We're going to discuss how we can read the Gospels as unique artistic narratives individually. We're going to discuss how the four images came to be associated with the Gospels, and then which one represents which Gospel. And then we're going to discuss the unique features of Mark. Depending on our time, we may get through two passages, if we're lucky. Otherwise, we'll get through the beginning of Mark, and that'll be enough if that's the case. I'm going to try to end just after the choir dismisses, but this is being recorded as a podcast, so you can always catch up if I bore you and you start to think about dinner or something like that. That's totally fine. It'll be recorded and uploaded later. There is also recommended books on the Gospel and Mark. Of those, the two that I'm relying on and one that I stole my title from is Richard Burridge's Four Gospels, One Jesus. You can find that used for under $10 on Amazon or other bookstores. He has three editions, but they're the same book. He didn't do any work to update it, really. And then Francis Watson's The Fourfold Gospel in 2016. Both excellent books to grab and have on your shelf. So let's talk about reading the gospel. So how we read a gospel. We can, these days, pick up our own personal copy of all four gospels, and we can read them side by side. Those of you who have gone to maybe taken a Bible class or gone on and done some grad work, you may have had a book called A Synopsis of the Gospels. I'll have a picture of that for those of you who are not familiar with that. But basically, you have a column of Mark, a column of Matthew, column of Luke, column of John, of each verse, and you can compare what's different, what's the same. And so when we talk about reading them horizontally, that's what we mean. We're comparing the words in one gospel to another gospel to figure out kind of the historical event. So what actually did Jesus say on the cross? Well, depending on what gospel you go to, you get different answers. So our tradition is this, you may have heard of this, the seven last words or sayings of Jesus on the cross. Well, that starts in Luke a couple times, and then that jumps over to John, and then we go back to Mark and Matthew for the next one, and then we go to John again, and then we end in Luke. So we get a comparative historical event of all of the sayings of Jesus. But that can tend to blur the emphases that the individual gospel writers wanted us to take away from their account of Jesus' crucifixion. We'll talk a little bit about Mark's emphases and how that kind of completely erases his if you do that. There's pros and cons to reading horizontally. You can, so just to talk about historically, this has been an option for some since about the 3rd century. I say some because you would have had to have been really high up in the church to have access to these very expensive books. So you would have been a bishop or somebody with some status, somebody that we still know their name at this point in history. Most people did not have access to any books, papyrus, at this point at all. And we'll get to this shortly, but what the peasant's Bible was stained glass or artwork, depictions of the Gospels, especially with literacy rates so low at that time. But it has been an option for, we might say, the elite, though there are some negative connotations to that. But that's the idea. Since at least the 3rd century. It's been popular recently, at least in my lifetime, to have a harmony of the Gospels. Maybe you've heard of this. In Bible college, that's one of your textbooks, is a harmony of the Gospels. We had one from A.T. Robertson, I believe. Some of you might have that same book, but this is essentially the same thing. Getting all of the different events that happen in the Gospels that are told different ways and smoothing it out and saying, here's how the event historically happened. So this doing this, reading the Gospels in this way, addresses some questions of like what actually happened. What's the history of the event? But it smooths out and eliminates the unique features in each gospel. So for Mark, it's theologically important that Jesus' last words are a cry of abandonment. And to have it superseded by a cry of triumph that we get in other gospels, that eliminates what he's trying to actually tell us about Jesus' crucifixion in Mark's gospel. God can speak through the gospel's individuality as well as through their unity. So it's not to say that this is a wrong reading of the gospel. It's to say that there are other ways that we might see Mark's gospel and Luke's gospel, Matthew and John, differently and uniquely, and experience God and Jesus' story in a unique way, in the way that they may have intended. And that we don't want to miss. So that's horizontally. Vertically, again, if we're thinking of those columns, which I'll show you in a minute, vertically would just mean just reading Mark, just reading Matthew. This has been the de facto reading of Christians throughout history. You didn't have different copies of different gospels until well after the printing press, so think 1500s afterwards, unless you were a monk, happened to be a monk in a monastery, or you happen to have access to some great cathedral in Europe. But most Christians did not. And so most Christians, especially early on, only had one copy. So you have communities that just had Mark's gospel, communities that just had Matthew's gospel, and they would just read and write and know that story. So this is how Christians have historically experienced Jesus' story and the gospel, by having a single gospel. This reading vertically preserves the author's voice. It preserves what Mark wants to say to us and all of its oddities, because Mark is very odd when he writes a gospel. It's very strange. But it preserves what he's saying and what he's doing. Even if we have no idea what it is today, it preserves that. It doesn't try to smudge away any sort of uncomfortableness that we encounter in the gospels. And it also, we might think of the Gospels individually as a type of sermon. They are biographies, they are the story of Jesus, but they also have theological points and emphases that they're trying to make. So if we think of them as narratives like sermons that have a point that they're trying to make to their audience, just like if 4 different preachers in 4 different cities have the same event or text, they're going to give 4 different sermons because their audience is different. They have different needs. They're in different places. It's that kind of idea as well. The same event happened, but there's different ways of telling it to get at different truths and get people to do different things in different places. So that's how I'm going to encourage us to look at Gospels, at the Gospels in this class. And we'll eventually start with Mark, but we're going to make our way through some artwork first. I did not put this on your handout. And I should mention, for those of you who are tech savvy, there is a QR code on the handout. If you scan that, you'll get these PowerPoint slides. They'll pop up on your phone. So you can zoom in and see what I'm actually putting up on the screen. So this is what, if you buy a synopsis of the gospel, or they're probably online for free these days, this is what you'll get. This is one verse. So a lot of work goes into this. You can see that Matthew has, "and when they came," in this verse. Mark has, "then they brought him." Luke has when they came, and John just omits it entirely. So when you're trying to smooth out exactly what you might have as a harmony or a synopsis, you kind of you give and take, basically. So you're going to eliminate some uniqueness to each gospel when you do that, which is, again, not a bad thing. It's just a different way of reading it than we might usually intend to. Any questions, reactions to this? Has anybody encountered this before? Anything?
Is there any one of the four gospels more so than the other three, which is more likely to be chronological in the ministry of Jesus?
Yeah. So the question is, just because we're recording this, I'm going to repeat it. Is there a gospel that is most likely the most chronological in how we understand the life and ministry of Jesus to have happened? Off the top of my head, I would go with Luke, but I did not research that before this, and I know this is recorded forever, so I'm going to preface that by saying I'm not entirely sure that that's correct, but I think Luke is probably, would be my go-to there. I'll research that and have an answer for you during the Luke week, and I'll be able to affirm or deny that. But Mark certainly, and once we'll get into this in a minute, but Mark is certainly not one that is chronologically linear. It's more like a tapestry. It's very circular in its storytelling, and that's on purpose. That's kind of his unique way of getting at theological points that he wants to make. So let's talk about those people without access to physical copies of the Gospels. Again, this is the majority of Christians who have lived and breathed on this earth. Most people have not had their own physical copies of even one Gospel, never mind four. Never mind the other ones that didn't make it into the canon as well. How did they learn about the unique features and stories in and about that gospel? Well, as the canon, so the canon is the how we got the books of the Bible in, which ones made it and which ones didn't into our current Bible. As that emerges throughout the early centuries in the church's life, four symbols kind of emerged alongside it. It was both an argument for their inclusion and against other gospels' inclusion as well. We get, in the Book of Kells, these four images representing the four gospels. We have Matthew as a human face, though he has wings. It's just supposed to be a human. We have Mark as a lion, though you have to question whether or not the artist has seen a lion before. Luke as an ox, whose feet are going horizontally here, so it's facing this way. And then John as the eagle, which looks more like a turkey to my eyes, but, artistic license, I suppose. But this is from the Book of Kells, and which is about, I think, 800, 900 or so. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. So it had been set in stone at this point. And we'll get a lot of we'll get some variation earlier before that as well. Yes?
Can you give a brief description of what the Book of Kells is? My memory is a little vague on that.
Yeah, the question is, what is the Book of Kells? The Book of Kells is a book that is beautifully decorated. It was decorated by the Celtic monks and preserved through various Viking attacks, and eventually made its way to a monastery in Durham. I think it's in Ireland. In Dublin, you can go see it. You can see a page, actually. You can't get within 5 feet of it, but you can look at a page through several panes of glass after paying an enormous amount of money to do so. But it's an incredible historical artifact that's beautifully preserved and decorated Very expensive. If you have pages and ink to do this with all of the intricacies and details, that costs a lot of money.
So is it just artwork or is it?
It's the entire Bible, I want to say.
New Testament.
New Testament, okay.
Okay, with art.
With art, yeah. There's additional art too, so when you open up to the actual book of Matthew, there will be a man's face with a whole bunch of Celtic knots and golding or gilding and that. So a beautiful.
Like an illustrated New Testament, is what you're saying.
Exactly. In Latin, I want to say, at the time. So that's what it is. So there's a lot of these that are being published by a lot, I mean dozens, because they were so expensive. And they had to be ordered by the church and paid for. Very few people could read and write at that level of training with Greek and Latin. It's a very, very precious item that was preserved. And so the story along with it kind of builds the mythos of how important it was. So the four creatures come from, and you have the text in front of you, the four symbols rather, Ezekiel's vision in Ezekiel 1. And Revelation 4, John's vision, which John's visions always end up copying Ezekiel's visions anyway. So it always goes back to Ezekiel and Revelation. In Ezekiel, if you look at the text really quickly, you'll see, as I looked, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud of brightness around it. In the middle of it was something like four living creatures. And as for the appearances of their faces, the four had the face of a human being, the face of a lion on the right side, the face of an ox on the left side, and the face of an eagle behind. So we get these four creatures with the exact same face, but there's four faces and they're all around. This is, in Ezekiel, the only part of his vision where the creatures have something different. They have the same hands, the same wings, the same feet, I think. But the faces have four different things on it. So that captured folks' attention when they were thinking about four as a potential number for the amount of gospels that was going round. In Revelation, we get a slightly different vision, though it's playing on Ezekiel's vision. We get in Revelation 4, around the throne and on each side of the throne are four living creatures, full of eyes in the front and back. The first living creature is like a lion. The second living creature is like an ox. The third living creature with the face of a human, and the fourth living creature like a flying eagle. So we get, four different creatures rather than the same creature with four faces, and they're like a lion. They're not exactly a lion. They're like a lion, which is probably what Ezekiel meant, but John is kind of amping things up a little bit. But the same exact creatures. So in Ezekiel's vision, if you go back and read it, which I encourage you to because it's wild, in his vision, he says he sees God high and lifted up. But before he gets to the high and lifted up part, he kind of gets fixated on the chariots for a bit. He's like, okay, there's eyes on the wheels and everything is moving. And then we get these four creatures. And then we get 30 more verses. And then we get to God and it's like two verses. So he gets really distracted by making his way up to see God. He almost gets distracted by these creatures. So early Christians kind of took hold of that. They saw any manifestation of God, which Ezekiel's vision was, as prefiguring Christ. And so, like these figures kind of led Ezekiel's eyes up to God, he kind of has to make his way through making sense of this vision before he can actually get to God actually manifested. Early Christians thought, well, the Gospels are kind of like that with Jesus. We get to Jesus through these four manifestations of his story. And so when we encounter God, we encounter God through these manifestations of his story, which are the Gospels. They really kind of cling on to that early on. So Francis Watson says, just as the prophet beholds the exalted Christ only by focusing first on the four living creatures, so we behold him only by attending to the four gospels. And just as Christ presented himself to the prophet by way of the four-wheeled chariot and its four attendants, so too he presents himself to us by way of the fourfold gospel and the four evangelists. So this is the analogy that early Christians followed. It took hold for centuries and was accepted as the reason that we have four gospels in our Bible and not 15 or 20. Any questions, comments, discussion on that part of the story? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So the question is, could I repeat the comment I made about the John, the author of Revelation, repeating Ezekiel? John and Ezekiel are both apocalyptic stories or language. That means that they are revealing something. That's what that word means. Ezekiel's visions and his language is all about revealing things that God has shown him to Israel so that they can do something. John takes language from Ezekiel constantly, and Daniel as well, but mostly Ezekiel, and plays with that in his visions and tells it a new way for Christians to now understand what God is saying. I think the bowls are in Ezekiel. Like they come up again, the seven bowls. The images that John uses are repeated over and over again. And they usually come from Ezekiel or Daniel, that Old Testament Jewish apocalyptic language. That's what I meant by that. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Any other questions, comments? Yeah. Yeah, so mostly monks would have done the artwork that is preserved. So we're going to go through, I'm going to show you, that might be the next slide, actually. Yeah, that's the next slide. I'll go ahead and jump to it, and then we'll jump back. It's on, if you look at the back of your handout, if you can't see the TV, actually, it's not on the TV, so if you have a handout, you have something extra. Look at that. The bottom left page. There is St. Mark. That's in the Lindisfarne Gospels. Has anybody heard of Lindisfarne before? It's an island off of England's coast. It has another name. What's that?
Holy Island.
Holy Island, that's right, yeah. And that's where monks have preserved the stories of and artwork of the Gospels. The Lindisfarne folio, if we want to use the academic term, was the first English Bible that we know of and have record of. It was written in Latin, but it has an English kind of translation underneath it so that people could understand it. So if you go on YouTube, the British Library has an excellent video kind of showing you the book and detailing it. It's really good. Yeah. So it's kind of circular, actually. So the theological arguments we get for the inclusion of each Gospels are going to be circular. And also their mapping onto the creatures are going to be circular. So in some instances, we'll have Mark. Eventually, we'll get Mark as the lion. But earlier, the way that the order of the Gospels was set out, Mark was also an eagle. And the theological kind of argument for it can fit anything. Well, Mark kind of theologically soars above us and is, you know, it just kind of fall. Once you decide an order, the theological arguments come from that rather than the other way around, if that makes sense. So the way that we got the four Gospels is kind of different. passed down because of their attachment to the disciples and the apostles and the way that you can vet them. So Mark was attached to Peter in the early tradition, that he got some of his stories, eyewitness accounts from Peter. John is an apostle, which is why sometimes in the early ordering of the Gospels, you get Matthew, John, Luke, Mark, because John and Matthew are apostles historically. So they need to be up front. Eventually, we'll get Mark as second because St. Augustine argued that Mark was a shortening of Matthew. It's kind of a summary of Matthew. And so people put that second. And then we get Luke and then we get John.
But now we believe Matthew used Mark as a reason.
Correct. Mark was the earliest gospel, not a summary of Matthew. We know that now. We think that. So let me back up. Has people heard of the term synoptic gospels? Is that something? Okay, great. So they're synoptic because they should be seen together. We think that Matthew and Luke used Mark. 90% of Mark is in Matthew and Luke. 90% of John is unique. So John is doing his own thing. Matthew, Luke, and Mark are in this category that we call synoptic. So the early argument was, how are they related and why? So Matthew was the popular gospel. Mark, nobody liked Mark. It's weird. It just ends. If you were at Sunrise Service, you heard Mac talk about that on Easter. It starts, and we'll get to his introduction, but it starts and Jesus appears. There's no infancy narrative. He just kind of is there. So people really wanted, we need more information, Mark. We need fuller background. And so Matthew and Luke came along and filled in the gaps. But yeah, I know that's a long-winded answer, but that kind of get to what you were talking about. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think that the way that scholars would talk about it is that John had had visions, and the way that he chose to explain it was through the language of the Old Testament, because that was the language that was in his heart. If we talk about Revelation at some point, which I'm sure we will, it's very tightly written, lots of sevens and threes, and it all has a purpose according to the author. So that is part of his purpose, is to link back to what was said. That's why he keeps talking about Babylon when Babylon hadn't existed for thousands of years at that point, because he's referring to Babylon in the Old Testament as a way to talk about Rome in present times. So yeah, he does lots of fun stuff. Let's talk a little bit about the art. I just pulled these from Google, and you have most of these on your handout as well. These span from 1860. So this one is from the 1860s, but it's a church in Ohio, St. Simon and Jude Catholic Church in Ohio. They have retained the four images of the gospel here. This is in their rose window. We have St. Grist Church in Wales represented here, and you can see the four images surrounding Christ. This is somewhere in Belgium. I couldn't find a date for it, but the images of the ox, lion, human are at the disciples' feet, the author's feet, and also up here, they're at the author's feet. Here, I thought was interesting is that it follows the old order with John second. You can see the eagle at John's feet, just there. That's called the old Latin order before Jerome came around and set everybody straight, basically. And this, which you have on your handout, is a plaque that you can see if you go to the Met in New York. This is from about 1000 A.D., from modern-day Germany. So it wasn't just stained glass. It wasn't just physical books that these creatures were appearing in to represent the Gospels. This was, I think, a door carving or a niche in a pole of some sort where people would walk by and see it and be able to understand it and read it. We have here Iesu, which is Jesus, and then Christu, so Jesus Christ. And you can see a little bit the nails, his hands are open, so we can see that. But he's surrounded by the Gospels here, the lion, the ox, the human, and the eagle once again. So this wasn't just a one-time thing. This was everywhere. This is how people related to the Gospels and understood the Gospels up until very modern times. So what I want us to do is to embrace the differences rather than try to kind of smooth them over, at least for this class. Richard Burridge, one of the authors of the books that I recommended, says, not only were these four Gospels, essentially, they stood for the Gospels, the four pictures, they were each recognized by its symbol right at the start without the need for reading, but this imagery was also used for summaries of the Gospel message. So Jesus was born as a man, sacrificed like an ox, triumphant like a lion, and ascended like an eagle. So not only did it take the idea of that we have four Gospels, but there are four key parts of the Gospel that people would immediately recognize by seeing these pieces of art and these creatures, particularly with these pieces of art. With that in mind, and because we have maybe 15 minutes left, let's jump into Mark, shall we? Mark's Roaring Jesus. So this is from, like I said, the Lindisfarne Gospel, which was written about 700 AD. Monks from Iona, actually, built a priory there. The earliest known Gospels written in a form of English. I doubt that we would be able to recognize their English, but it was a form of English. If you want to see it, it's at the British Library. Let's talk about the unique aspects of Mark. So Mark is the earliest gospel written, which is not a historic position, as we were just talking about. Only in about the 1800s did we come to realize that Mark is probably the earliest gospel written. Up until then, everyone kind of believed what St. Augustine said, is that Mark was a summary of Matthew. But we did more critical thinking came out around that time. And so now we believe Mark was the earliest gospel written. It's more likely that something was added to than taken away. Mark has a short, abrupt style. His sentences are usually short, to the point. He's not long and flowy like Luke, and he doesn't put in a lot of Old Testament language like Matthew. He has a kind of a short, abrupt style. And this makes sense if you understand how expensive it would have been to create any sort of book this size. When you think about the length of Romans, we know that Romans probably took $4,000 to $5,000, probably more than that with inflation these days, but a very, very expensive letter, and Mark is much longer than Romans. So this is a very expensive undertaking. So he has a very short, abrupt style, we think probably has something to do with that. There was no commentary on Mark until about 400 AD. No commentary on Mark that we know of. The earliest one we know of is around 400, 500 AD, something like that. But people even then would just acknowledge that Mark existed and then go like, okay, now to the real show, Matthew, and get really excited about Matthew, but not Mark. So until about the 1800s, then Mark is very much now in vogue. If we want to talk about Gospels being in vogue. So why a lion? What's the theological rationale about Mark being a lion? What makes people connect a lion with Mark? Well, the introduction to the book is usually how the rationale is described for each of these characters. Or creatures, rather. So the setting of being in a desert is the very first setting of Mark's gospel. So a lion roaring in the desert is reminiscent of John the Baptist, which is the first character we encounter in Mark. So a desert and being deserted as well. We begin with John the Baptist, who Mark says was wild and who he doesn't say he was wild. He is wild and roars in the wilderness is kind of the metaphor. But Mark does include that Jesus, during his temptation, was among the wild animals, which other gospel authors omit. So this aspect of Mark really got people to think about him as a lion. It really is what beat out the eagle in the argument that was occurring in the first couple of centuries. That's chapter 1, verse 13. The temptation is among or with the wild animals. So that is kind of how people talked their way into Mark being a lion. And those are the things that people would remember when they didn't have access to a papyrus, a book, to be able to see what the introduction of Mark is. Well, you have a lion, you remember, oh yeah, it begins with John the Baptist, and then you remember from there, kind of the outline. So that's kind of how it worked for over 1,000 years, really. Before we get into Mark's themes, does any questions, comments, anything like that? All right, well, we'll continue. The big themes of Mark, so all of Mark is really, really focused on modeling Christian behavior, so through Jesus' actions. So Jesus shows us how to be a Christian. We imitate his actions and also the ideas behind the action. All the Gospels do it, but Mark is really, really focused on it. He talks about the identity and the imitation of Christ. The very first sentence in Mark, this is the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Immediately we have an idea of who this Jesus is and what his story is going to be about. There is almost no teaching in Mark, as far as we understand it, as far as Matthew is concerned. Can anyone guess how many parables are in Mark? There are very few, yes. Anybody? You want to be brave? What's that? There are some. There are just over two. There's four parables in all of Mark. Only four. So if we only had Mark, we would only know of Jesus teaching four parables, which is kind of astounding to think about. He doesn't care about teaching. He cares about action. And so Jesus is off doing stuff. He's doing healings. He's doing exorcisms. He's doing all this kinds of action. He's not sitting teaching like in Matthew. He's on the move. So the word immediately is used 42 times in Mark, which is more than the rest of the New Testament combined. 42 times. When he says immediately too, this often doesn't come over into English because it's very bad English to start every sentence with immediately. But there is probably a connection there with straightening the paths that is talked about in Mark 1, as far as John the Baptist is concerned, and then afterwards. The word for straightening is related to the word for immediately. It's on your handout, because I'm not going to try to pronounce the Greek there at this time at night. But if you're interested, that might be a fun little rabbit to chase in your free time. We have in Mark a cosmic and apocalyptic Christ. We have healings and exorcisms are a part of this cosmic battle. Things that are happening on earth reflect a wider cosmic reality. Matthew will call it the inbreaking of the kingdom. But realities that are happening, demons are being exorcised, evil is being chased away, things are being made right, paths are being straightened. All of this is the inbreaking of the kingdom, the way that things should be and could be with Jesus's divinity and divine action. This is at the heart of Mark. More exorcism, I believe, than other gospels. They tend to cut some out. They're like, we get the point, Mark. We're going to cut out two or three of these. The difficulty of discipleship is a huge aspect of Mark, to the point where if you read through Mark, you're like, what are the disciples doing? They're very, very harshly characterized. There's one story in particular after Jesus crosses the sea in Mark 6, where the way that Mark describes the disciples' reaction is they were afraid of what just happened because they didn't understand about the loaves, which were Jesus whenever he broke bread and did it for the feeding of the 5,000. So they weren't afraid of Jesus crossing, walking on water. They were afraid of, because they didn't understand the loaves that had happened back a couple of chapters ago. So Mark is constantly saying they see, but they don't see. They hear, but they don't hear. So playing with that Isaiah passage that is underlying, seeing but not seeing, hearing but not able to understand. If we have time, which we probably won't, Mark 8 really does that. Mark also has deep, deep irony, really, really big irony. So if you go through and read Mark on your own, be on the lookout for these types of things. And I'll give you a few examples. The leper disobeys Jesus, the one who has healed him. So in the next aspect, few verses, Jesus himself has to act like a leper by living in the wilderness in order to escape the crowds because he went and told everybody. But then in a final layer of irony, Jesus' efforts to escape the crowds fail, and they come to him in the desert. So they come to him as a ritually impure leper. So there's a deep sense of irony there in healing someone who is ritually impure, who had never been able to be around crowds, who now Jesus can't be around crowds because he healed the leper in the first place. There are other themes in Mark that irony kind of plays into, like discipleships. The 12 repeatedly struggle to understand Jesus' identity and teaching, despite his repeated efforts to teach him. It's like, look, this is going to happen. The literally blind Bartimaeus is able to identify Jesus. He's able to see Jesus without seeing Jesus. The disciples aren't able to do that. The Pharisees, who watch Jesus closely so they can accuse him of Sabbath breaking for healing someone on the Sabbath, then ironically begin to plot Jesus' death on a Sabbath. The touch of the hemorrhaging woman, which under the law of Moses sort of rendered Jesus unclean, instead renders the woman healed rather than Jesus being rendered unclean. In Mark 6, the disciples of John the Baptist come forward to claim John's corpse and bury him. Later, Joseph of Arimathea, not Jesus' inner disciples, claim Jesus' body to bury him. The irony in Mark's gospel reaches climax in the death of Jesus, where Jesus is mocked with symbols of kingship. The reader understands Jesus is the true king, making the mockery ironic. Jesus in Mark is enthroned on the cross, not the resurrection. In the other Gospels, it's the resurrection or the ascension where Jesus is enthroned as basically proving he is who he's always said he is. In Mark, it's not. And it's hard for us to see if we don't understand the irony that Mark is trying to get at. By putting a crown of thorns on Jesus' head, they are literally crowning him King of the Jews. By putting a mocking sign on the cross calling him King of the Jews, they are literally describing who he actually is. With the shame and abandonment that Jesus experiences on the cross, it's amplified ever so much by Mark's narrative. Even the women who see the crucifixion, Mark describes them as looking on from far away. They're not even close by. Jesus is completely abandoned and having a shameful death. But that death is, in fact, what causes him to be enthroned as the person who he said he was. And the person to identify that is a Gentile army officer, not even his disciples. We also have, in the structure of Mark, I'll talk briefly about this, we're almost out of time. It's not linear. Mark moves in circles. He'll say, and Jesus immediately went across the lake of Galilee and did this. And immediately he went right across the lake and did this too. And then he went up across the lake and did this. So it's not exact. It's not chronological, and it was never written to be chronological. It was written more as a tapestry to show us themes of Jesus' ministry, actions, and even teachings four times, so that we get a picture of who Jesus is so that we can imitate him. The structure of Mark hinges exactly on Peter's confession in Mark 8. It's exactly in the middle of Mark, 16 chapters. This is in chapter 8. It's exactly when there is a turn towards the cross in Mark. Almost half of Mark is Jesus headed towards the cross. Passion is much, much more of an emphasis in Mark, much longer. And there's more to say there, though I don't think we have time, unfortunately. There's a fancy word called intercalation that Mark likes to use in his structure. The 50-cent version of the $5 word is Markan sandwich. This means that Mark starts a story, interrupts himself, and then finishes the story. He does this, if you'll remember, with the healing of Jairus' daughter. And he'll connect the two stories because he wants us to interpret them together. So Jairus' daughter is 12 and is sick. And then before Jesus can make it to Jairus' house, a woman who's been hemorrhaging blood for 12 years interrupts Jesus and healing goes out from him. Then Jesus returns and heals Jairus' 12-year-old daughter. So he wants us, when he does that, he wants us to interpret those together. And there's various points that we could make there. But that's the important part about the structure of Mark, is that he builds on theological points by using intercalation or Markan sandwiches. The other gospel writers don't do that nearly as much. Okay, we have maybe 5 minutes. So let's talk about Mark's gospel as it's written. We're going to talk a little bit about Mark 1. We get... this is the beginning of the gospel, the good news of Jesus, the Son of God. And so we're ready to hear about Jesus and who this Jesus is. And Mark immediately gives us a prophecy, and we're excited to hear about how this relates to Jesus. But then we hear that it's not a prophecy about Jesus at all. It's about John the Baptist. So he doesn't even begin his story at all with John the Baptist or with Jesus, but turns towards John the Baptist. We get people from Jerusalem, the urban center, the Charlotte, if you will, coming out to the desert to follow John the Baptist. But we hear that people up in Galilee are also coming down. Galilee being Western North Carolina, I suppose. It's out there. It's a different state they're coming from. And they're coming from the country, and they're coming from the cities. And they're all coming to John the Baptist to be baptized for repentance. Jesus appears. He just appears. There's no introduction. There's no, and Jesus traveled, you know, so-and-so days. He just is there. We're to understand that he traveled from Galilee somehow and arrived. He just appears, no fanfare, one amongst the crowd, and then he's baptized. But his vision of being the Son of God is private. It says he saw. Not everyone saw. So this is Jesus. This is confirmation to Jesus about his mission in the baptism that he experiences from John. And then he's just sent. He's just gone. And then he goes into the wilderness. We never hear from the crowds again. John the Baptist only appears because his disciples, we are told he's killed, and then his disciples appear briefly. But all of that scene kind of peters out. And so it's a very weird way to start a story about the Son of God by having a baptism by someone that he assumes his audience knows who this is. There's no need for an introduction, really. They just vanish, John and the crowd. So why do we start with John instead of Jesus? Why is Jesus being baptized by John in the first place? And how has John done any preparation? How is he making ways straight at all? The short answer, again, because we're running short on time, is going to be that Jesus' baptism and the word spoken are a model of Christian initiation. This is what all Christians go through when they are baptized. It does not concern him alone, his baptism. The new identity bestowed on him through the Spirit and the divine voice is open to participation from others. This is how we should be reading this. This baptism is an inclusive event, and Mark's Christian readers recognize it in their own experience. Their own experience of turning from the old life to the new. That's why his account of the ministry of John the Baptist can be presented as the beginning of the good news. It's the beginning of our own way, our own journey, which involves carrying our own cross, as we'll witness Jesus do in Mark. The word gospel here doesn't merely refer to a narrative account of Jesus' ministry. The good news only becomes good from the viewpoint of its recipients, from the standpoint of its own recipients. That's Francis Watson. So here we have a renewing of a broken covenant. Jesus is coming. The repentance is to be understood as a repentance of Israel turning back to God because of the broken covenant that they have broken. And Jesus is it's the beginning of the renewal of that covenant. It leads to rural and urban people alike to come and experience baptism for the repentance of sins. The event that inaugurated Jesus' ministry is reenacted when anyone joins the Christian community. That's what Mark really wants us to understand. He wants us to understand that historically Jesus was baptized by John, but this is the beginning of a journey that we're all on. And as we journey with Jesus, we'll follow with him up into the cross as we carry our own cross, understood as discipleship by Mark. We're going to not do Mark 8, and we'll go to the ending of Mark. Again, here, it's heightened by irony I've already spoken of, as the king is enthroned on a cross and not a throne. He's given not a royal crown, but a crown of thorns. So in Mark's roaring gospel, Jesus triumphs not as a conquering lion, but by becoming a lamb. Enthroned at the crucifixion rather than the resurrection or the ascension. This is similar to, you might have heard, this language in Revelation 5. John plays with this idea too. So he looks, the lion of Judah, look, the root of David has triumphed. And I turned and I saw a lamb, not a lion, looking as though it was slain. That's really, really important for both the theology of Revelation, but also understanding Jesus' sacrifice. In the moment of his crucifixion and abandonment, the lowest point of shame of being crucified as a criminal, it is that moment that he becomes the savior of the world, not a victim of it. And invites Mark then ending his gospel in the way it is. The shorter ending of Mark is most likely original. Mark may have died before the composition finished, but obviously early scribes were confused and alarmed by it enough to create at least two additional readings, which is how we get those additional readings. But Mark's ending invites us to reread the Gospel of Mark. It ends with a command to go back to Galilee. And that's where it all began in the beginning. Jesus ventured from Galilee down to the desert to be baptized. And that's the invitation that Mark has for us as we finish with this crucified yet victorious Savior.